What's the difference between a need and a right? I mean, clearly, food is a biological need for human beings. But you, should you have the defensible legal right to access food?
And how do you get it?
That's exactly right. How would you enforce that? In India, one politician, at least, is trying to make food a human right. But is that actually going to make 420 million people eat, have access to breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day? We're joined again by Raj Patel, fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy and author of both Food Rebellions and his latest book, which is called The Value of Nothing. Good morning again.
Good morning, Celeste.
And we're also joined by Chris Jocknick, a lawyer and director of the private sector department at Oxfam America. He teaches a class on business and human rights at Harvard Law School. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Raj, there are certain countries that have defined food as a basic right. Is that not correct?
Well, in fact, the human right to food is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it's an idea that every country in the world has signed up to if they signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And there's only one country really that's sort of backpedaling from that. And in 2008, as recently as 2008, there was a vote on the human right to food, and 180 countries agreed to it, and only one country voted against, and that was the United States. And of course, the U.S. has already signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I think it's widely recognized that there is a human right to food. And the question, the very interesting question that India's decision prompts is, or India's sort of political situation at the moment prompts is, well, what is the best way of doing it? And there's actually been there's a growing number of countries that have decided that one of the ways to do this is to write it into the Constitution. Brazil, most recently, had a congressional approval to change the Brazilian constitution to build in the human right to food, to make it a part of the fabric of the country.
Right, but Raj, we're talking about the kind of the collision between practical realities and ideals. I mean, one can say in the U.S. that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but those are intangibles. We can't go to court and sue someone because they've interfered with our pursuit of happiness, for the most part. And although the right to food is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there are still millions of people who suffer from hunger every single day. I mean, what if I have an extra building full of food and I'm hoarding it? I guess, according to the law, does that make someone, a hungry person, able to sue me for my excess of food?
Well, you're asking a question that, of course, goes back to the very sort of foundational debates around human rights. Jeremy Bentham was very clear about this idea that, to quote him, natural light rights is simple nonsense, it's nonsense upon stilts. And he in fact, talked about hunger in particular, saying, wants are not means and hunger is not bread. So you're right that merely sort of waving the idea of a human right around is just so much hot air unless there's the force of law to back it up. But that's the whole point of putting it into the Constitution, is that you, by so doing, you open the door for actually people to be able to take legal action rather than to have a long charter of rights that seem like just so much toilet paper.
All right. Well, Chris, let me ask you. We actually started this conversation at our website, and one of our listeners had this to say. By definition, rights are entitlements, things we deserve with or without any action on our own part. It seems everything is becoming a right. No one has to work for anything anymore. Healthcare, food, housing. If we're entitled to these things like we are to the air we breathe, who in their right mind will work to create the food? No, it's not a right. You have the right to get a job for the money to buy the food or work to grow it yourself. What's your response?
Well, this is the tough part about rights, when you assume that a right means that you're immediately going to get access to that particular good. But that's not the way we look at rights generally. I mean, if you take a right in the U.S. that we're very comfortable with, the right to due process, 200 years ago when we put that into our Constitution, no one really knew what that was going to look like, and it certainly requires a lot of effort on the part of government to respond to due process. And for many countries, elections, due process, the right not to be tortured, those all require a lot of action and a lot of spending on the part of governments. But we just assume that governments have to do that, and by putting the right in there, we are starting that debate about what that obligation on the part of government will look like. So rights always require certain action by the government and certain investment, and then rights don't turn people off and have them go home and just wait for things to happen. On the contrary, what rights do is they inspire action on the part of civil society. And again, take the U.S., something like the Second Amendment right to bear arms. that right alone has changed the way we understand guns in the United States, for good or for bad, and it has energized enormous debates and enormous activity on the part of citizenry. The same way, if you take something like food, which is absolutely essential to survival, 30,000 kids dying every day because of a lack of food, and you turn it into a right, what you're saying is not tomorrow every person is going to be fed, but you're saying that this is important enough that it has to be part of our national debate, and we're going to start holding our government accountable, and people are going to start getting more engaged on those issues in different ways. And that's what rights are all about. They're not an end point. They're a beginning point. And they take something out of the normal realm of day-to-day, and they inscribe it as something absolutely vital. And then they start putting pressure on governments and on civil society to start realizing it.
Okay, so Chris, you heard Raj talking about how the United States was the only one that did not agree that food was a human right in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What is the difference in an approach to human rights in the U.S. as opposed to some of these other countries?
Well, the U.S. has always had something of an exceptionalist attitude towards international law and treaties. We're one of two countries that has not ratified the one treaty that everybody figures that you could ratify, which is the Treaty on Children's Rights. It's only the U.S. and Somalia that refused to ratify that one. So it's not that strange that the U.S. has taken this attitude. But what is ironic is that at the very beginning of human rights, in the 1940s, you had Eleanor Roosevelt as really our leading voice on human rights, and she said at the time that the right to be free from hunger was the most important right of all, and it was her husband FDR that pronounced freedom from want and as well as freedom from fear as basic rights. And so, the U.S. has a history of promoting and respecting economic and social rights. We understand the right to education as a basic right in most states. And across the country, which is certainly an economic right. We're very aware of labor rights, which are economic rights. And so we understand these basic economic issues, but we have trouble with a few around the edges: health, housing, and food. There's just this individualism or this
right.
different way of looking at things in the U.S. Where we resist those sort of basic issues as rights.
Chris Jochnik is a lawyer and director for Oxfam America. Raj Patel, a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy. It's a fascinating discussion prompted by this proposal in India. Give us your take.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.